¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
From the number one sports site in the world.
Big names.
Bold interviews.
Beyond the X's and O's.
Welcome to the fastest 2 hours in radio.
On Yahoo Sports Radio.
And YahooSportsRadio.com.
This is the Big E Sports Show.
With the one and only, the triple threat. The Big E.
Melissa Walker Campbell. The 6 foot former Sooner women's basketball player.
She can post, pin, and produce with some of today and yesterday's biggest stars.
Alyssa Walker Campbell delivers sports the way you want it. Get ready to go beyond the X's and O's
with today's star athletes, coaches, and sports figures.
This is the Big E Sports Show
right now.
Now from the Quicken Loans studios of Yahoo Sports Radio.
Are you ready?
Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze.
Here she is, the one and only, the Big E, Alyssa Walker Campbell.
Okay, welcome in this evening to Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show, the fastest 2 hours in radio, where we always deliver the biggest and the very best in sports. And right now, all eyes are focused on college basketball and all the magical moments of March Madness. We've certainly witnessed some exciting overtime games, some big-time upsets, and hopefully your bracket is not like mine. It's not all busted up, and it has played out the way you anticipated. Well, this evening, we have invited back a very special guest, and that is the Texas Tech head men's basketball coach, the great Tubby Smith, who I have to share with all of you tonight. I was so impressed with his crossover move because we enjoyed watching him serve as an analyst for CBS Sports and the NC2A tournament coverage. Thank you so much for carving out some time and joining us this evening, Coach.
Glad we could be here with you. Thank you, Lisa.
Well, let me, before we break down the season and kind of reflect on how everything played out, what was that experience like for you? You know, you're a legend in the game. You've got that amazing basketball mind. Do you have a sincere appreciation for us folks that are now in the world of journalism and being an analyst?
I have no advice. I don't know whether I could do that or not. That's a tough job you guys have in the media. Mm-hmm. I was very impressed with, you know, the way they, you know, the setups and, you know, the producers, people in the ear, you know, they really didn't, you know, I wasn't as prepared as the guys that were there doing the show. Mateen Cleese was already, you know, we had a lot of people that were involved up there, and Pete Gillen, you know, we had Coach Lapis from Bullets. So it was a lot of guys that do that on a regular basis. But I got to stick with coaching. I hope I can do a better job of coaching than I did on CBS. But it was a great experience. And it was a fun thing to do. I tell you what, there's a lot of upsets, a lot of things. What a great NCAA tournament we're having.
Absolutely. It's so true. And it certainly was some wonderful exposure for your program. So let's get back into your comfort zone, and that is on the sideline. You're only one of 9 coaches in the country to take 4 different schools to the NCAA tournament. I know this past season it was difficult for you not to advance to postseason play because that's your first time as a head coach, but you have had a chance to kind of step back and digest how the season played out. What was your assessment?
Well, it was obviously we expected more, but we took over a program that really had some tough times over the last few years. And as a coach, you have goals that you want to achieve. You have individual goals. You have each individual has their goals within the team, and you have overall team goals. We wanted to achieve, get the postseason play this year. It's something that a kid like Jay Crockett, who's been here for 4 years, didn't have the fortune or wasn't as fortunate enough to play in postseason play. But I like the way our kids competed, even though we didn't get the postseason play. 14 wins. It was tough to accept the number of losses and accept not getting the postseason play. But we're changing the culture, as most people do, most coaches do when they take over a program that has had some losing. It's tough to do. I was fortunate enough when I took over at Tulsa and at Georgia, mm-hmm. at Kentucky, where the teams were, they had been winning programs. They had had wins previously, and they had won but this program, 3 out of 4 out of the last 5 years, losing, it's tough to do. But I like the way our players responded. I was happy for them because we won some good games, some big games. Really had some nice sellouts here at Spirit Arena. So exciting time in Red Raider basketball.
And Tebby, you're right on because you defeated three top 25 teams this season. Of course, finding success against Oklahoma State and even the Sooners. We are going one-on-one with Tebby Smith, Texas Tech head men's basketball coach this evening at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big East Sports Show. I want to step back for just a moment. You're talking about, you know, when you're rebuilding a program and you're getting guys to buy into your system, there are growing pains there. And I know for you as a coach, there's got to be times that's just overwhelming when things are not going as planned. And you look at your schedule, there were some stretches there where you're losing 5-6 games in a row. What is your source of strength, and what is that belief to keep believing that you guys are going to be trending eventually in the right direction?
Well, I look at the losses. You know, you look at how you lost the games. That's a lot of people say it's not, you know, it's how you play the game, and it is. If you see that your guys are competing hard, for instance, Iowa State, we played extremely well after coming off of a good win at Oklahoma. And we were in that game the whole, we ended up losing by 6, but it was close, even closer than that. Then we go to Kansas, you know, we have Kansas at home, we lose by 1, we should have won that game. Or at Oklahoma State, we had a big loss, but we came back, bounced back against Kansas State and had the game in hand and didn't a call here, a call there. So you actually, what sustains you during that time when you're having, when it's tough times? You got to believe that your players are playing hard. You got to keep measuring how. And we measure their deflections and the number of times we get steals, blocks, take charges to get on the floor. So I thought our kids hustled all year long. And that's what sustains you through that. And then to bounce back and get that win against Texas at home was huge going into conference tournament.
Absolutely. And that was on senior day too, right?
Yes, it was. The first time they've won on senior day in 10 years. It's amazing.
Yeah, and I was going to say, let's highlight some of your seniors because you had, 4 seniors this year? And it's important to point out, I was thinking back to our earlier conversation at the start of 2014, and your guys had been through a lot in terms of your seniors, just the coaching transition, and that is never easy. If you've ever experienced that as a player, it's very, very difficult. What will you remember the most about each of them?
Well, I mentioned Jay Crockett from the beginning, just his belief and his love for Texas Tech. Red Raider basketball. You know, he's a kid that probably could have left, but he decided to stick it out, and I appreciate that on his part. And all the teams you have, Jay led us in rebounding with 6.5 rebounds a game and scoring, averaging about 14 points a game. He just was a good all-around player, the first player to make all Big 12, third team, first all Big 12 player we've had in 7 years, I think, here at Texas Tech, just to give you an idea of what Jordan Jay Crockett accomplished. And then Deion Kravitz, who was a 7-footer from Canada, who is redshirted, and he averaged 7 points and 4, almost 5 rebounds a game. Those guys he was like 9th all-time as far as block shots are concerned in Texas Tech history. So, and then Kadir Topsopo, who was from a junior college and had one of his best games this year, had his best game ever against Mount St. Mary. It's a team that went to the NCAA tournament. And then Jamal Williams, a young man who had started here, but he came off the bench and gave us good defensive. But those 4 seniors were quality people that showed great leadership throughout the season. And if your seniors are not buying in, when your seniors buy in, especially guys that have gone through 3 and 4 coaches, the way they had, it could be tough. But they made it pretty easy for us this year. Made it a very comfortable year as far as coaching was concerned.
Tebby Smith has been with us at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big East Sports Show, just kind of giving us a reflection on how everything transpired this past year. I'm very excited as we get ready to close out our interview. Big-time positive for the program. You guys just hit the recruiting trail very hard and just signed Justin Jamison, and we're looking forward to the kind of impact that he will have with your program and, of course, in the very tough Big 12 Conference. Tebby, thank you so much for joining us, okay?
Thank you. I'm excited about next year. Thank you.
Absolutely. Much more straight ahead this weekend at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big East Sports Show. Join us online at Twitter at eRadio Sports, and we will be right back.
You're listening to the Big East Sports Show on Yahoo Sports Radio. Once again, the host of the fastest 2 hours in radio, here's Alyssa Walker Campbell.
The Big E.
Okay, welcome back this evening to Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. I am Elissa Walker-Campbell. Join us online at Twitter right now, at E-Radio Sports, and our Major League Baseball team preview continues this weekend. And right now, we're going to focus our attention on the Philadelphia Phillies. And 2013, to be completely honest, it was one of the most disappointing seasons. I mean, my goodness, they finished below 500 for the first time since 2002. And as a result, the Phillies fired their longtime manager and was replaced by rookie skipper Ryan Sandberg. So we have invited back to our program author, sports writer, and baseball historian Fran Zimnick to give us the pulse on what are some of the issues that will need to be addressed in 2014. Good evening, Fran. It's wonderful to have you with us on a Friday night, date night with the Big E. How are you?
Big E, there's nowhere I would rather be on a Friday night than on a date with you.
Well, you sound kind of like Marv Levy. Where in the world would you rather be than with the Big E Sports Show, right?
There's no other place to be.
Very good. Well, listen, we are going to shine the spotlight on your Philadelphia Phillies and what are some of the biggest strengths and perhaps weaknesses this year. But before we do that, talk to us. What in the world is going on with the Philadelphia Eagles? I mean, you got the DeSean Jackson saga that's unfolding. Michael Vick is gone. He is now signed with the Jets. Why or why not DeSean Jackson? Why would he not be a part of it in 2014? I mean, his numbers say it all.
He had great numbers, but he also has a really big contract, which he renegotiated once already. And the team wasn't even off of the field in their playoff loss against New Orleans when he was asking to renegotiate it again. He's going to make $10 million next season. And I think that what's going on here is that he was drafted by Andy Reid and that group. And Chip Kelly came in, and he didn't draft him. He just saw a guy who was a little bit of a problem child in the clubhouse. Wasn't a real team guy, but you know, when you come on the field, he's a tremendous talent. But I just think there's a lot of things going on behind the scenes, and from what I understand, last night they had a little talk with him, and they say he's coming back now. But I mean, if he starts up and acts out again, I have a feeling they might just release him.
Well, Fran, what about, we definitely want you to weigh in on as far as the quarterback shuffle. The Jets signed Michael Vick and released Mark Sanchez. A little bit of a flip-flop going on here. And now two USC players will be backing up what Nick Foles. I mean, what do you think about how that's playing out?
Well, I'll tell you what, they're probably going to have a lot of fun on Saturdays watching college football. But, you know, Mike Vick, I don't know. He really can get a lot of different people really upset or really very much in favor of him and whatnot. He, as you know, I love dogs more than I love most people. Mm-hmm. So I don't understand what he did or why he did it or whatever. It was a cultural thing or whatever. But at the end of the day, he made some serious mistakes, but he owned up to them. He went to prison. He lost every cent that he had. And I don't know. I'm one of these people. I think if you really show remorse and you try to make up for it, you deserve a second chance. The court dictated to Vic when he got out of jail, he had to make X amount of appearances in schools and things like that. He did that tenfold. So I'm of the opinion that a lot of us just deserve a second chance in life, and he got a second chance and has made the most of it. Now, the reason that he's not back in Philadelphia isn't necessarily because the Eagles didn't want him. I think they would love to have him back here as a backup or insurance for Nick Foles. But he wants to be a starter, and he's getting to the point now. He's in his—I guess he's 33 or 34 now.
This is 33.
Probably his last go-around as a starter, and he's going to really push Geno Smith in New York. In fact, unless he gets hurt, I predict right now that Vic would be the starting quarterback there.
Well, I'm so glad you're talking about Michael Vick because he really does. I listened to an interview earlier this week on ESPN, and he does seem like a changed man. He is 33 years of age. I think he's grown. He's matured. The humility. And I really love, as I was listening to him, just the posture of his heart. I mean, he truly seems like a changed man. And I love the fact he seemed like such a team guy. I mean, the dynamics between him and Nick Foles and how he really mentored him in many ways and helped him step up and elevate his game. I mean, you start looking at Nick Foles' numbers that he did. I mean, 27 touchdown passes and only two interceptions and 8-2 regular season record.
He played so well. It's incredible. And you're right, absolutely right about Michael Vick. He was a tremendous team guy, a great teammate. And it wasn't just Nick Foles. It was to everyone on the team. And he was always there. He was a mature voice. He was everything you want in the clubhouse as far as a team leader. And just the fact that he was able to give up the starting position to Foles and not be a distraction, not be a problem, I think shows a lot about him as well, the maturity level and how much he cared for the team. Because he has just incredible respect and love for the Eagles organization, because basically when he got out of jail, they were the only team willing to give him a chance. And he has a lot of respect for Jeff Lurie and for the team, and I think that respect and that loyalty really showed through. So I have a lot of respect for the guy.
Were you surprised that Chip did not want to keep him?
I don't think that's the case. I think Chip Kelly would have loved to have had him back, but I think Vic really wants to be a starter, and he knew that wasn't going to happen in Philly. So I think the Eagles would have brought him back in a second as a backup.
Fran Zimnick is joining us this evening at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. He's an award-winning sports journalist, and so let's move ahead here. Let's talk about the Philadelphia Phillies, and how would you summarize how last season played out? Because they only won, 73 games, a major drop-off, and a downward trend. They really struggled offensively. Why were they so unproductive, Fran?
I think a lot of it was injury. It was an ugly season. And you know what? I grew up with Phillies teams that really stunk. And then all of a sudden you get six or seven great seasons in a row and you get very spoiled. But it was just brutal. As the Phillies offense goes, I think Ryan Howard and Jimmy Rollins go. And Rollins doesn't seem like he's all that motivated a lot of the time. I don't know. He's been a great team leader earlier on when he was trying to get the team to the point where they could get into the playoffs and do something. He was wonderful, but he's a little bit of a malcontent from time to time, and he doesn't hustle all the time. He's still, though, one of the best shortstops in the game. Ryan Howard has, for the most part, missed the most part of the last two seasons. I just watched a game earlier today. He looks thinner. He looks healthy. And if Ryan Howard can hit 32 home runs, and if Cole Hamels isn't hurt, and he's had a little shoulder issue in spring training, I think the Phillies team could at least compete for a playoff spot.
Well, they only scored 610 runs last season, and we were talking about just how unproductive they were. But obviously the biggest strength for the Phillies this year, it was pitching at the top of the rotation with Cliff Lee and with Cole Hamels.
Well, Lee looks incredible. He pitched a game, I guess it was the earlier part of the week, where he went into the fourth inning without throwing a pitch out of the strike zone. And that just is incredible. Hamels is a fantastic pitcher. He's had a little bit of a problem with his shoulder. They don't think it's real serious, and hopefully it's not, because Lee and Hamels at the top of the rotation are pretty impressive. And they also brought in A.J. Burnett, who has looked real good in spring training. So there's some good starters there, along with Kyle Kendrick, who's a holdover, and they brought in Roberto Hernandez, and they have a young kid named Jonathan Pettibone, who looked really good last year. So there is some hope there. It's just that you need this team to stay healthy. That we have not, when the Phillies won the World Series, there was literally hardly any injury problem at all that season, and then it sort of catches up to you. But if this team can stay healthy and someone like Ryan Howard can produce the way that I think he can, it's going to be a fun summer.
Fran Zimnick, an award-winning sports journalist, columnist, and author who has written for various newspapers and magazines for over 25 years, always producing great books. And my final question for you, we've got 30 seconds. How much of a concern is it that the Phillies really are an aging ball club? I mean, many of their best players, they're in their 30s.
Well, that's a huge concern, because it's this kind of situation now where you need everyone to stay healthy. If everyone on this team stays healthy, they're going to compete. But what are the chances of people in their early to mid-30s all staying healthy? It could happen, but it's a little bit of a long shot.
You're listening to the Big E Sports Show on Yahoo Sports Radio.
Once again, the host of the fastest 2 hours in radio, here's Alyssa Walker-Campbell.
The Big E.
Okay, welcome back to Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. I am Alyssa Walker-Campbell. We're so glad you're along with us for the fastest 2 hours in radio. And we love you being a part of our program each and every weekend. Email the show at Alyssa@YahooSportsRadio.com. And also you can follow us at Twitter at @eRadioSports. Well, as promised at the top of the show, we want to take time to forecast and preview the 2014 Major League Baseball season. And what a terrific run for the Boston Red Sox in 2013. They certainly did make it happen and prevailed in a season that no doubt will be remembered forever. Winning it all, winning the World Series, and in fact, the third World Series for the Red Sox since 2004. So many big moments and memories. We're going to reflect on that in our next segment. We're also going to preview what Red Sox fans can anticipate in 2014, and we will take time to reflect and celebrate baseball's journey of the great Shane Victorino, who was so instrumental with big hits, timely at the plate, and we're going to learn a little bit about his journey in baseball. In fact, I think it's so interesting in this book that we're going to be talking about. He spent time in my hometown of Great Falls, Montana, in the minor league with the Dodgers. So it's such a pleasure to welcome in tonight sports author, award-winning journalist who has released a new book. It is titled My Baseball Journey, Shane Victorino, the Flying Hawaiian. Good evening, Alan. It's wonderful to have you with us tonight.
Very nice to be with you, Alyssa.
Well, thank you for joining us. And before we profile the Gold Glove outfielder, the World Series champion of the Boston Red Sox, Shane Victorino, let's get your thoughts on the upcoming season, because it's kind of hard to top the 2013 campaign when you're top of the world and world champions. Is this a team that is poised to repeat?
Well, that's exactly right. Last season will be very difficult to top. This was a team that had a magical season, a magical run through the playoffs, a team that if you saw them play in August and September, just had the look of a champion. And of course, when you get to the playoffs, anything can happen, but they took on the best competition that was out there and took care of business along the way, creating some real iconic moments. So coming now to 2014, is there a way to top last season? I don't know, but I think that certainly getting back to the playoffs and making another run at the World Series certainly is a realistic goal for the Red Sox. I think adding to the drama of this season is the fact that there are rivals. The Yankees have retooled and added some high-priced free agents. So whenever you have a robust Yankees-Red Sox rivalry, that's good for baseball in general. And then we can't forget the other talented teams in that division, the Rays and the Orioles. 2014 and the American League East alone should be an incredibly dramatic season. I think the Red Sox are poised to be very competitive this year. They lost very few pieces from their championship team last year, and the pieces they did lose, they were able to replace with other players. So I think that it is a realistic expectation that the Red Sox will be in the mix again this year.
A number of veteran players. We are zeroing in on the Red Sox organization. What are some additional various elements within this team that you believe that will once again lead them to the promised land?
Well, I think in baseball, more so than even in other sports, it's that elusive sense of chemistry. And when I referred earlier to watching them in August and September of last year and seeing them gel into a team that had obvious chemistry, and I think led by players like David Ortiz, and mm-hmm. even though Shane Victorino is now going into only his second year with the club, I believe he has taken on some leadership responsibilities. This team just seems to have terrific chemistry, and I think a lot of the credit for that has to go to their manager, John Farrell, who came in, took over a team that had finished in last place in 2012, and just created a team.
And that's one of my takeaways from last year's incredible run, was just the closeness of this team. You can tell that the guys, they really cared about each other, and that is such a critical element in any sport.
Yeah, I have to agree with that, and I think the outward manifestation of the chemistry and the team unity was the beards. I think that's what everybody remembers about last year's Red Sox.
Of course,
team,
yes,
they all grew the beards, mm-hmm. and that, you know, I think that was it's sort of a superficial thing, but I think it brought the team together. But this was definitely a team that you didn't hear anything about clubhouse acrimony. You didn't hear anything about bickering, and of course in 2012 when Bobby Valentine was managing the team, that's all you heard about was chicken and beer in the clubhouse and fingers being pointed.
It
certainly wasn't the situation last year, and I think, yes, you have to have talent to win baseball games, but you also have to have that team chemistry as well.
I think one of the things that was observable, too, was obviously the great balance of personalities, but that blue-collar approach, and that's truly what helped them win in 2013.
No question about it. I think that a team that can come up with the timely three-run home run or grand slam certainly is going to pull out games that they might not otherwise have won. But the blue-collar way of playing the game, again, exemplified by a guy like Shane Victorino, legging out a triple, hitting and pulling off a hit and run, stealing a base, really scratching out a one-run victory along the way. You do that 10 or 12 times a year, that makes a big difference in the standings.
Well, we will be shining the spotlight very bright this evening on Shane Victorino. Of course, we're going to be talking about the brand-new book written by Alan Maimon. It is titled My Baseball Journey, Shane Victorino, The Flying Hawaiian. But I do want to back up just a moment. You had mentioned manager John Farrell. I mean, you sound like you have a lot of confidence, obviously, in his abilities. What do you appreciate about him the most and his ability to lead?
I think a manager who recognizes that he has talent can take a step back and not be the center of attention all the time. I think that there are certain managers who enjoy the spotlight maybe a little bit too much, and that can have a detrimental effect on a team. I think John Farrell, with his background as a pitching coach, first of all, did wonders with that pitching staff, but then just knew when he could let his players lead. And I think that's why I don't think you could really come up with a more successful first year as a manager as he had.
Alan Maimon is joining us this evening at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. I am your host, Elissa Walker-Campbell. Connect with us online at E Radio Sports at Twitter. Alan, tell all of our listeners this evening where they can go and they can online right now check out where they can get a copy of this book.
You can go to Amazon.com and you can punch in Shane Victorino's name, and the book will come up. It's also available at BarnesandNoble.com and available in some, if not all, brick-and-mortar Barnes & Noble stores, but certainly on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and also directly through the publisher's website. That would be TriumphBooks.com.
Well, Alan, we have talked so much about the positives with the Boston Red Sox, the clubhouse, the close team, these guys, how much they really care about each other, and so many of those critical elements. But the Red Sox had a relatively quiet offseason with what only really the major change of being Jacoby Ellsbury now with the Yankees. What is your biggest concern or perhaps roadblock preventing them to get to the highest level again?
Well, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, I think was certainly the motto that applied to the Red Sox during the offseason. However, as you pointed out, they lost a key piece in Jacoby Ellsbury. What they've gotten, at least this spring, is an incredibly unexpected performance out of Grady Sizemore, who is looking to resurrect his career in Boston and looks to be now the starting center fielder for Boston. So if Sizemore can step in and more or less make up for what they're losing in Ellsbury, that would be a huge advantage. And then at shortstop, they have a young 21-year-old kid, Bogart, stepping in for Stephen Drew. I think the biggest question mark for the Red Sox, as it is with many teams that hope to be competitive, is can the starting pitching rotation stay healthy? They have a few guys who are getting up there in years, many of whom had career years last year. If the starting pitching starts to break down, that's where the team could perhaps encounter some problems. Staying healthy, always important for a team like that.
Alan, how much does the loss of Jacoby affect them?
Well, I think you have to look at it in a couple ways. Not only what does it take away from the Red Sox, but what does it give to their arch nemesis, the Yankees, who the Red Sox will be duking it out for division title. I think Jacoby Ellsbury is a wonderful player. He's a throwback player in his own right, a guy who can steal 50 bases but can also hit a home run from the leadoff spot. Grady Sizemore has big shoes to fill, but if we recall, about 5-6 years ago, Grady Sizemore was the Jacoby Ellsbury of the American League.
We are zeroing in on the Boston Red Sox this evening at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. Also, we will be featuring Shane Victorino talking about this brand-new book that is out. It is titled My Baseball Journey, Shane Victorino, with the author Alan Maimon. We're going to step aside for a quick commercial break. We will be right back with much, much more this evening at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. Join us online at Twitter, at E Radio Sports, and we will be right back with much, much more and Alan Maimon.
You're listening to the Big E Sports Show on Yahoo Sports Radio. Once again, the host of the fastest 2 hours in radio, here's Elissa Walker-Campbell.
The Big E.
Okay, welcome back this evening to Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. I am your host, Elissa Walker-Campbell. We're having a wonderful conversation this evening with Alan Maimon. He is a sports author and an award-winning journalist that has re-released a new book. It is titled My Baseball Journey, Shane Victorino, The Flying Hawaiian. And Alan, before we went to break, we were talking about the only major change with the Boston Red Sox really was with Jacoby Ellsbury, now with the Yankees. But I have to wonder, too, I mean, I know the Red Sox, they have a reputation of having a very strong farm system. system with some exceptional players that have a lot of upside. And I know that you also, I have to mention, you've got another book that's out, and it's titled, Hits and Misses in the Baseball Draft. So you know about these young and up-and-coming players.
Yeah, it's an area that fascinates me, just how championship teams build themselves. And normally what you see is it's through a combination of free agent signings and trades, but also building from within. And maybe the St. Louis Cardinals would be the best example of a team, a perennial winning team that has built from within. But the Red Sox have done a pretty nice job of that themselves, mm-hmm. with Xander Bogaerts and Jackie Bradley Jr. and Brandon Workman. Even teams with the deepest pockets find that a key piece here and there, a young call-up in September, or somebody who has come up through the system who has been sort of schooled in the ways of the organization, you can't put a price tag on that, somebody who's come up through the minor league system and then makes an impact in the majors. So even for a big market team like Boston, they've done a pretty nice job of developing young talent from within. The other book that is currently out that I did is called Hits and Misses in the Baseball Draft, and it looks at every team's success rate when it comes to drafting players, especially players drafted in the first round, many of whom never even make the major league. So it really looks at how the minor leagues is this really brutal weeding out process for even the most highly touted prospects, and how raw talent doesn't always equate to proven ability. But again, in the case of the Red Sox, they've done a nice job of turning their highly touted prospects into productive major leaguers. And I think this year we'll see that impact, Xander Bogaerts being a good example. He will be their starting shortstop, 21-year-old kid, playing shortstop at Fenway.
Well, the good news for the Red Sox is they don't have to rely heavily on inexperienced players. I mean, they obviously are so deep and they have so many veteran players. But even when you step back and think about what happened and how the season unfolded in 2013, I mean, injuries, they're always going to be a factor in the game, but it was remarkable about how many key players last year really had to muscle through those injuries, whether it was Mike Napoli or Stephen Drew or even Shane Victorino. I mean, he had sore hamstrings and had to work through that.
Yeah, you hear players talk all the time about the grind of a 162-game season where you're playing 162 games in something like 180 days. So the nicks and the bruises and the strains and the pulls really start to add up. And I think that having young guys who can step in is important for that reason, to replace injured players. It's also important because we've seen this with other teams where they enjoy a period of success for several years, but they allow their core to age, and there aren't the young players who have gotten their feet wet along the way to step in and replace the aging veterans. And I think the Red Sox as an organization understand the importance of making sure that the young players come up while the team is still successful, kind of break in those young players along the way.
Alan Mamon is joining us this evening at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. And let's shift gears here and totally focus our attention right now on the new book that you have out, My Baseball Journey, Shane Victorino. And I'm very excited for you to just to kind of share with the listeners tonight. Just it really is a fascinating account of an unlikely American success story. Just give us some of your takeaways from the book and just what kind of feedback have you received?
Well, Shane Victorino's journey to the major leagues it was certainly a unique one. When he made his major league debut, actually all the way back in 2003 as a member of the Padres, he was a Rule 5 draftee by the Padres, mm-hmm. and was up in the big leagues for only about a month at that point before getting sent back to the Dodgers. The Padres basically got a quick look at him and determined that he wasn't going to be a part of their future plan, so they shipped him back to the Dodgers, who proceeded to cut him loose again, and he ended up with the Phillies, where he really caught on and started to he actually became a key part to of a team's golden age. The Phillies won 5 straight division titles with Shane Victorino mostly playing center field for them, started out playing right field for them. First major league player from the island of Maui since the 1920s. So right there you have a special story, a different kind of story. Scouts were not flocking to Maui to take a look at Shane Victorino. Shane Victorino is on the small side, about 5'8", 5'9", very fast, obviously. But, he's not from Florida, he's not from Texas, he's not from California. So here was a kid who played 4 sports in high school, was an outstanding baseball player, but just really didn't draw the attention of scouts to any extent. Ended up being a sixth round draft pick of the Dodgers, and struggled as he made his way through their system and thought about leaving the game on different occasions. A key part to his story is the attention deficit hyperactivity disorder that he has suffered from his entire life, going all the way back to childhood. And anybody who knows someone or who has a child who has this disorder knows that one of the key symptoms of it is that sufferers have a very hard time controlling their impulses and channeling their energy in a positive direction. So as a child and as a teenager and even into his early 20s, Shane really had to work on controlling himself. Back as a child playing youth football and youth soccer, he would routinely get ejected from games. He would his antics on the sidelines would incite brawls in the stands. I mean, this was a kid who really needed to learn to focus himself because he had all the talent in the world, but he couldn't control his impulses. So for those reasons, where he came from, what he has overcome, as you said, I think it makes his story a very uniquely American success story. He's now a two-time World Series champion, one of the very few players who has won a World Series with both the Phillies and the Red Sox. And, it's all there in the book, from childhood to the Phillies World Championship in 2008 and, of course, to the Red Sox World Championship last year. And he played a very instrumental role in making that happen.
Absolutely. And, of course, in this book you chronicle, just as you're talking about, the personal, the professional battles that Shane went through. But just out of curiosity, I mean, how was he able to finally get the disorder you're talking about, attention deficit, that had really impaired his ability to stay mentally focused? How was he able to get that under control? Was it medicine? I mean, what made that happen?
As an adolescent, he started taking ADHD medication. And this was in conjunction with meeting with a therapist. So there was some behavioral modification techniques at play, but there was also medication. And that really helped him as he got into high school, as colleges started looking at him as a potential soccer player or football wide receiver slash kicker. The medication helped him focus on the field. And another symptom of ADHD is hyper-focus. So he really poured himself into sports 100%. That's what he really poured himself into. Now, there was a period of time after he got drafted by the Dodgers that he stopped taking the medication. I think both he and his parents felt, oh, well, this is something that he's going to outgrow, that the ADHD will simply go away when he reaches adulthood. But that didn't happen. So in 2005, when he was with the Phillies AAA team in Scranton, Wilkes-Barre, he went back on the medication, and that really helped him buckle down one last time to make that last push to reach the major leagues and to stay in the major leagues.
What did you share about as far as when he left Hawaii and then he went to the minor leagues with the Dodgers? And I was talking about my hometown of Great Falls, Montana. I mean, because that is, you know, so different than being in Hawaii and then going to, you know, a population of 50,000 and some very different temperatures. It's not the most tropical place to live.
Yeah, for a kid who grew up on a idyllic island paradise, I think landing in Great Falls was a bit of a shock to the system, and I believe the first time he joined the team was in Canada, Medicine Hat.
Oh yeah,
where he joined the team, and he had a very inauspicious start with Great Falls. In fact, he in his first game with the team, he knocked the Dodgers' first round draft pick unconscious accidentally. Shane was playing center field and a Texas League hit fell in, and a runner was trying to score from third base, and Shane ran in, picked up the ball, and without even looking, just whizzed it in to try to nail the guy at home plate, but he didn't see that Jason Repko, the team's shortstop, was only about 10, 15 feet from where Shane was, and he beamed Repko right in the head and knocked him out cold. So talk about arriving in a place that is foreign to you and then going through an experience like that in your first game. It taught him to deal with adversity very quickly.
Well, Shane Victorino, only a select group of players that can say that they have played such an instrumental role in helping two different teams win a World Series, of course, with Philly and with Boston. Alan, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you with us this evening at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. Again, the title of the book is Shane Victorino, The Flying Hawaiian, and you can go anywhere online at Amazon.com and get a copy. What a pleasure. We definitely want to have you back. Thank you so much, Alan, okay?
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
Congratulations. We'll be right back with much more at YSR, the Big E Sports Show.